One of the themes that I have in mind for the upcoming period of time, we've just finished our winter retreat. We're coming to the end of the Vaisak season. And then in July, we'll be starting the 3 months of the Vasa, which is the time that for the monastics, the special thing that we do is we decide to stay in one place. And that physical decision to stay in one place means that we will be staying with whatever number of companions we have in that one place. So we are settling with a community and a place. It's very much an opportunity to take the idea to grow where we are planted. So whatever is the next important thing for us to work on in our practice, this is the time to be really present for that. This is the next thing that we have on our plate. So if we have learned about samadhi, sama samadhi, meditation, and we feel that our meditation is not everything it should be because we've been busy doing ordinations and having different kinds of activities. Then we may decide, okay, this time we're going to circle back and just be available for that. It's very interesting. Sometimes it's not what you expect when we say grow where we're planted. This past winter, during our winter retreat, that's the second time from January to March when we are together on a more quiet and stable type of basis without as many activities. My adhitana that I made at the beginning of that time was that the previous winter, the community had supported me in having a personal retreat time. So they were so generous. I went out to the Aranyabodhi, and I stayed in one of those little cabins that we have there at our Aranyabodhi Hermitage. And the only thing I had to do was to go down the hill once a day and receive lunch and give a blessing for lunch. Other than that, it was just me and these four walls and this wood stove and this firewood and nothing to do. It was such a wonderful experience, having such a privilege to be supported, to have everything I needed to be provided. So then during this winter retreat, I wanted to give back. I wanted to give back in service. And so one of the monastics in the community had been doing a lot of administration work. And I said, okay, you don't have to do that anymore. You picked up so much admin when I was the previous year from me, and then you kept it. You've been working so hard all this time, so now give up all your admin and give it to me. And then while as I was on retreat, I, Tathaloka, and I, Brahmavara, and I, Sivijana, had been making such an effort in giving the Dhamma teaching. And I said, Venerables, you don't have to do anything. I'll take care of the teaching. And then in the past, we took turns with the person who's the retreat manager. That's a kind of just taking care of the making sure that the necessary things happen to keep life going on during the retreat. And I said, Venerables, don't worry. We don't have to do a rotation. I'll just be the retreat manager for the whole 3 months. So each day, I had to look at the email, and I had to take care of this and take care of that, and I started doing a checklist in the, this is something in the Google Calendar they have with tasks. If you think you need to do something, you know, like, okay, today I'm going to check the emails, and I'm going to send one letter, and I'm going to sweep. So I put those things down on the checklist, on the tasks. And then when I did them, then I would, you tick the button and it goes poof, it's gone, it disappears from the list. And so the more that I gave, the more I felt grateful. It was such a, just a really unusual, I don't know if I'm not a generous person normally, but I just had this decision to serve. And I wasn't doing it because anybody was asking for something. I did it because I put my hand up. I said, let me, you know, let me serve the community in this way during this period of time. And so for me, that was my way to, it was like to grow where I planted, just with something that, that came up, that appeared, okay, this is an opportunity for me to develop something that's a good quality, a good character that I want to have more of. More recently, I'll give you another example of growing where one is planted. The founding teacher in our community, Aya Tatalloka, is a very highly accomplished scholar of the Vinaya. She studied not only the Pali Vinaya of our tradition, that's the rules and regulations and the procedures of the monastics. She also is very well versed in many of the, like what's the normal cultural styles of different communities around the world. And she spent time in Korea, so she's quite familiar with the Dharmaguptaka tradition of Korean, so, which is a different school of Vinaya. So Aya Tatalloka is able to give like a PhD class, and she usually does during the Vasa. She gives a kind of an advanced seminar. But it just so happened that when we came out of our winter retreat, we got several young bhikkhunis coming to join us who had only been ordained for 1 or 2 years. And one of our long-term residents here is one who's only been ordained for 1 or 2 years. And we had another one who was a seminary Tavira, who was ready to be ordained. And we had two other people coming in who were monastic aspirants who were very interested. So they were all so interested in learning. And so then my idea is, it just came to me in a flash, I'm not qualified to give the PhD level seminar in the Vinaya, but I'm qualified to give the, like, sort of like the high school level. I just feel that it would be beneficial if each bhikkhuni comes to understand the Pali of each rule. Once a month, twice a month, we recite, that we sit together and we recite the rules and regulations. It takes about between 1 hour, an hour and a half of a recitation. And it's all recited in Pali. And those who are skillful reciters go very, very, very fast because they want to get it over with. And those who are junior, they don't have it all memorized well enough to follow the Pali, to keep their place on the Pali, and also to know the meaning. So my idea was, I just think it would be nice for me and it would be nice for everyone to know the meaning of each rule well enough so that when we listen to it, we're not just hearing blah, 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 blah. We're hearing something that's telling a story about the about our discipline, our way of life. And then we're supposed to be like reflecting, it goes along and sort of like taking our inventory and say, well, have I kept this one or not? And so, and then as well, I'm interested in Pali grammar, so we started a little class. It's a very simple class. We meet for 30 minutes each day, and we read over one page of the rules, and we read them in Pali, and I'm doing my homework is to prepare the word about the trilinear, which is the literal meaning of each word, and then putting it into colloquial English. And so we're just pronouncing, practicing the pronouncing. We go around the circle, each one has to pronounce them, right? And so then everybody gets to hear that rule like five or six times. They get to hear the rule in the Pali language. And while we've got the TV is on with the word for word meaning. And that's it. Such a simple, it's so simple. But the students are so appreciative and grateful. And I'm appreciative and grateful too, because it's something that I'm able to give that brings so much joy, because it's something that I'm able to teach, and it's something that just, by a miracle, we have these five women here, and they want to learn it. Now, you know how tough it is to be a teacher when the student doesn't want to learn. I used to have one student who was a steward years ago, and every time I would like offer some teaching, her response was kind of like, "No, I'm not able to do that." But then afterwards, she would make the effort and she would do it. But always there was like this sort of like this resistance, and then at another occasion. There was a different student, and if I would make some kind of suggestion, she would just say okay, and then she would go off and she would make the effort with that, and then she'd come back later, and she'd give a report saying, "I'm making the effort with what you suggested, and this is the result. Do you have another suggestion for me?" See how nice it is when you have a student, but people are different. But what I'm trying to say. Describe as just by the changing circumstances and the variety of people and the events and the circumstances that come and go in our life, these things can spring up to us because, we've had some knowledge, we've been practicing for a long time, and we can say, yes, this is something which I'm able to do, which is good and it's beneficial. Let me undertake that. Let me quickly undertake doing that. And this way, this is how we grow in the Dhamma. And now I want to just stop now with that very simple idea and hear your report or your question. It could be if anybody has a question about meditation, please ask the question. Or if you have anything to report about how in your life, what it would mean, a question or your answer, what it would mean to grow where you're planted and to pick up the next opportunity for something wonderful to develop for you in your practice. Is one of your group going to be the MC for answers and questions? I'll call on Isabella.
Hello. Thank you so much. I've noticed lately that I am not as focused as I need to be when I meditate. And I mean, I know that that's the practice, but also I'm kind of a little bit deluded that I thought I was doing it right. And then I started to really listen to instructions, and I realized that I'm not at all doing it right. So it made me, and when I really do it correctly, in other words, when I'm just setting my mind free and not at all trying hard, then I do feel this real sense of release and this sense of, eternity and freedom, and so I know I can do it.
Yeah.
And so I just realized that the last couple of weeks, and mostly the last couple of days. So my focus will be to really get to that place and to hopefully deepen my practice. And it's interesting that you say to grow where you are planted, because I have been complaining that I am living far from family and friends, and it's going to be a while before I can move back to where I'm from, and I really need to try to grow where I am and not be so distracted, and I need to embrace that in a literal sense.
Yes.
So thank you so much for that query. And
Thank you for that wonderful report. There's one of the ways of looking at the different styles of meditation is there's a meditation which is very following a very clear and precise procedure. And trying to stick with it. And it's like getting into a harness and trying to stay on that track and just putting the energy to stay on a certain track. And there definitely are rewards in learning how to see the way the heart sometimes rebels against that, doesn't want to. When the mind wanders away from the theme of the meditation, I always say the mind, it wandered because it wants to wander. And I said, oh, that's a very interesting learning opportunity. What was going on there? What does the mind want? Why did it want that? And what does it feel like when the meditation failed because the mind wandered? And then what does it feel like when it wanders, and what does it feel like when it comes back? But then more and more actually exerting willpower, going, it is possible. We're not a victim of our mind. We can make choices about what kind of thoughts to entertain and what to do with our mentality. Then there's a second kind of meditation, which is more described as it could be like open field of awareness, or sometimes it's called mind in the middle. And this is where you just become still and allow whatever comes up to come up. So whether awareness about the state of mind, awareness about a sensation, awareness about a feeling, whatever comes up, you just are sensitive. And that kind of meditation, especially for a beginner, can be almost impossible because the mind just starts going into stories and you spend the whole time on your shopping list or worrying about your problems. But I find it's very useful at the beginning of meditation. Actually, take a few minutes and do that mind in the middle and just say, it's like, I'm holding a mirror and I'm saying, hello, Somana, how are you today? And then I'm really listening. What is the body telling me about where I'm at right now? What is the mind telling me where I'm at right now? And I don't have any special expectations. I just present for whatever is coming. And then after doing that for a little while, then coming into a more methodical kind of meditation. And then it's like the question, like what the impact of the meditation is on the mind and body. We can notice that if we've developed our mindfulness so well that we know what's happening, what it's like. So my suggestion is do a little bit more effort, but don't blame yourself if the mind is sort of loose and wandering or something like that. That's also a part of meditation. So I'm taking these in order that I see the hands. I see a question from Alice. This is Alice coming in from Texas, I think. Alice. Yes.
I'm not from Texas.
Oh, excuse me.
That's okay. Maybe there's another Alice that's from
Yeah,
Texas.
could be.
Okay. Anyway, so these same two methods of meditation, can we apply those same two methods when we're not meditating? We're just doing our daily life. Can we be aware of the difference, and can that be beneficial? I don't know if that's clear, but I just know that when I think that I'm being present, sometimes there are thoughts of the past and sometimes of the future, but I'm aware that they're thoughts of the past or the future.
Right.
So
And
it
it
is
would be
still
difficult to
present.
go through daily life, wouldn't it, without thinking of the past and the future?
Oh, okay. So that's okay. But then this other kind of meditation where you're just, I don't, so then I would think I would do the same thing that I would do when I was meditating, if I was just not meditating and I had that, what you called the middle of the mind kind of meditation, and I noticed a reactive kind of a, like a judgment or a resentment or an anger, I would want to just not have the story. I would want to just go to the emotion, I think.
Yeah. What I suggest is that from time to time, going through the day, especially if you have a day that's somewhat peaceful, try taking some actual your cushion practice and bring it out into the all the postures and the activities of the day. So if you want to have really good awareness of the breath, try going through your chores and the work that you have to do in the day, and as much as possible, notice breathing in and breathing out.
Okay,
That
that's a
it's
fun,
quite
easy one.
difficult to do, very challenging. Or else, if you're interested in like noticing, you mentioned like a judgmental mind coming up, that these different emotional responses are like often manifested in like the energy that comes up in the body and the mind and the how the perception, there's some kind of perception involved in that. I have a perception that so and so always does that, and then saying like today, I'm really going to try to develop more, being more acute and more sharp to notice different perceptions that come along. So after you've done that, that's like sort of practicing doing your push-ups. And then you can just relax and go through a day, but you've built up your mindfulness so that then as you go through the day, your awareness is so much more. And you can find that the balance and the harmonious and joyful aspect of life can be so much more as a result of being more mindful. So indeed, you're right. You can be like trying to do a specific practice all through the day. Or else you can try just go through the day in an ordinary way, but to be mindful.
Okay, thank you very much.
I see it's either going to be Corey or Margaret or both of you.
Do you have a question still?
Yep.
Hi, I'm Margaret. And I don't know if this is a question, but I just wanted to say I really appreciate you sharing about the cycle of staying in one place, of growing where you are. And that I've really been very challenged with that lately because I grew up as a child and all the way through my life until the last few years, very active and externally adventuresome, and I haven't been able to do that lately. And I've been limited by some pain and ambulation. So it's just a good reminder that there could be some benefit to staying, to being in one place, to not be moving and out all, as often as possible.
Right. One thing, two things spring to mind with your comment. One is an idea that I heard about from Quakers, but I think it applies to Buddhism. And that is the idea of hallowing our afflictions. So whatever difficulties or challenges or problems that come along is the most richest opportunity to grow in our grace, wisdom, and balance, to learn how to stay balanced in the midst of challenges. That's one thing that comes to mind. And the other thing that comes to mind, I feel that you are doing a lot better than you think, or a lot better than you gave credit in what you just stated. I think you've got a lot more on the ball in terms of mindfulness, awareness, and wisdom. And part of what we need to do is, if we studied what the Buddha advised, what the Buddha said, the way to live, the way to grow in this practice, if we have these victories, these moments where we do the right thing, we should have the frame to notice that, to notice that clearly and put a kind of like a spotlight on it, saying, yes, this is in line with the Buddha's teachings, and I am doing what's in line with the Buddha's teachings. So, for example, it might be that, just at this moment, you don't hate anybody. It could be that you went through the whole day without hating anybody, but how many times did you notice, oh, the Buddha advised not hating, and I'm not filled with hate? See? So there's many ways that if we recognize the simple positive things that we're doing, and that's like the stepping stone, the ladder of growth along this practice. Everything the Buddha taught always started at a level that was quite simple and attainable, at a level that even a child can understand, not to mention an adult who's been practicing for a while. And so start there and then go from there by just becoming a little bit more mindful, more clear, more wisdom, and consulting the suttas and consulting what the Buddha taught, and think about how that applies to the situation. Thank you so much for that report. I appreciate that. I'll call on Mary.
I have a kind of a weird question. I've been reading a lot about the Vinaya lately, and finding it very, very inspirational. And wondering if you have any thoughts how a layperson could and somehow use that in our lives. I mean, to something on the same kind of order where these beautiful kind of very structured advice on how to live.
Well, one thing about the Vinaya that I think is a useful concept is that they become very clear about what the factors are that defines a particular rule and whether you actually had a fault in respect to that rule. So, for example, we're supposed to not take food unless it was offered by hand the same day. Okay. One of the factors of that rule is knowledge. So if I thought the food had been offered, but it wasn't offered, then I don't have a fault. It's like my understanding, according to what I know, how things are done around here, that, like, my expectation, it was offered, but then somehow or other it got put on the table and it wasn't offered. So I don't have a fault with that. And so I don't have to feel remorse or guilt or worry about it. So when people are so vague and unclear about what their morality is, then they really can be set with remorse. And so having just becoming like clear, like what is our responsibility in terms of our intention, in terms of our perception, and in terms of our action. That's one thing that I think is really good to learn. And then the second thing to understand about the Vinaya is that whenever there's somebody makes a mistake or does something unskillful, there's a way of taking care of it. And it's not brutal. It doesn't mean that they have to, be put in jail for 20 days or that they have to go without lunch or something like that. Instead, for most of the time, the only thing that they need to do is just acknowledge that they made a mistake. They do this in person with a friend. And then the script that's followed is that the friend would say, Venerable, do you see? And you say, Yes, I see. And then your friend would say, Venerable, you should not repeat this in the future. And then you say three times, I will not repeat this in the future. Sadhu, I will not repeat this in the future. Sadhu, I will not repeat this in the future. So, like when I was a little kid, my parents were very gentle. They were very intentional in their parenting. But sometimes, if my mother was like not liking something about the way things were going or how people were acting, my mother would become very quiet. And when my mother became quiet, the children were all terrified. But then in other families, the parents were like too punitive and harsh, or they would, hit or punish in some kind of harsh ways. And then the children would not want to acknowledge their faults to the parents. They wouldn't want to, they would do anything to avoid getting caught. But instead, if you could have a family where you would encourage your children to be really honest and acknowledge any mistake or fault that they had or any problems that they have, and then treat them with such kindness and gentleness that then they always want to come back and they want to do that again, then you have a family based on honesty and forgiveness. And then it's the same thing in your place of work or in the system of justice, like if in any kind of circumstance, if we can practice this kind of gentleness, this acknowledging and this communication and this forgiveness, that's the way to create communities that have this kind of reparative justice, where the purpose of the justice system is to take somebody who might be alienated and to let them come back and be integrated to become belonging. And so this has got a very powerful impact that can be done in many different settings, all the way from the family to the United Nations. I think we could learn to practice more reparative justice by following that example. But you're, all of us, if you want to read the Vinaya, if you find anything in there that's useful, you're free to use it. And what you can't use because it doesn't seem to apply to you, then you don't have to use it. Okay, thank you. Part of the practice of peace are the specific practices that the Buddha gave about this social harmony and learning, the particular techniques of conflict resolution. And so there's a book by Bhikkhu Bodhi called The Buddha's Teachings on Social Harmony. So that's sort of like the beginning level. And then at the ultimate level, when we come home, when we have our finally reached the like the noble level of this practice, then we will be able to become really cleared out of greed, hatred, and all kinds of self-conceit, egotism, defensiveness because of protecting the self. All of those things will drop away. And so then that's the basis for a very deep kind of equanimity, deep stability of character, where nothing that happens can be a shock anymore. Even if the monastery burns down, even if we're put in prison, even if there's so many changes happening that it seems to be almost like life is destabilized, like you had a certain kind of plans and then the plans didn't work out. No matter what it is that happens, none of those things become a disturbance anymore. And then it says, when the mind is not clinging to anything, then there is no disturbance. And then that person is said to be the sage at peace. So the sage of peace is an epithet of a fully enlightened arahant or a Sammasambuddha, one who, whatever circumstances that comes up, really it will be a compassion, will be the kind of the operational response rather than any kind of a defensiveness or emotional reactivity. So this is the other aspect. And I think to get there, in the meditation practice, it's really wonderful to be very honest with ourselves. And they say that obtaining a samadhi is when the five hindrances drop away, and so greed, hatred, restlessness, sleepiness, or doubt drop away. And when those factors drop away, the mind is not disturbed, and the mind doesn't want to run around anymore. The mind is happy to come to stay within the meditation. So then we can't get there until we can see our failures. We can see our failures to get there, our failures to be peaceful. We can see what is, something blocking our meditation. And then we have a chance when we see what the failures that are blocks are, then we have this beautiful opportunity to investigate, what is really there, like at some kind of like a deep psychological level. There's something in me that like doesn't want to wake up because I'm afraid to wake up or something like that. Because I want to keep my pleasure, or I want to keep my identity, or something like that. And so then when we can't take care of those habits until we can see them, and we can't see them until we're honest. And so it would be that self-honesty and being willing to, in a way, face the, I don't know, I don't like to say dark night of the soul because that's not a Buddhist thing, but we can face the challenges and the difficulties and the distress and the failures, and then just by facing them, then the way opens. Just by making the right kind of effort, following the procedures, following the teachings, then in the course of nature, we grow out of those difficulties. And it's not that we got out of our difficulties by using our willpower and putting a whip on ourselves and saying, you must grow, you must become completely good, or you must wake up. Instead, we just follow, we have that self-honesty, and we follow the teachings. And then our growth in the Dhamma is happening by a process of nature. I think we might be coming close to the a time when this program is supposed to finish?